Does God keep his covenant? Well, in chapter 8 of Genesis, verse 22, while the earth lasts, seed time and harvest, winter and summer, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, will not stop. God is keeping his promises because it is getting colder. Do you know anyone who has kept their promises for over 4,000 years? We're going now to turn to Genesis chapter 1 and 2. This is the creation story. Some people think that there's no covenant here because the word covenant is not used. This is an improper approach to literature. Let me give you an example. Supposing I asked you to study the concept of king in the book of Isaiah. Well, obviously you would look up all the occurrences of the word king. But how about this verse, Isaiah 66:1? This is what the Lord says: Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house you will build for me? Where will my resting place be? The word king is not in that verse, but it's shouting kingship. So you can talk about something without actually using the word. Why don't we see the expression to cut a covenant in Genesis 1 and 2? Well, it would have been anachronistic because it belongs to a later stage in the history of the ancient Near East. Some people think that covenants happen only after man rebelled against God and sin came into the world. That is not true, because marriage is before the fall into sin, and marriage is a covenant. We can also exclude the idea of covenant by defining the word too narrowly. Paul Williamson wrote a book called Sealed with an Oath, and he argued that there was no covenant in Genesis 1 and 2. Well, you don't see an oath there, but maybe not every covenant has an oath. It has a commitment, but it doesn't necessarily have to have an oath. So just because we don't have the word covenant doesn't mean that there isn't a covenant there. I'm going to focus on Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. The creation narrative is divided into seven paragraphs. In the sixth paragraph, on the sixth day, we read about the creation of animals and the creation of humans. Verse 26, God said, let us make man. This word means humans in general. This word Adam means both humanity in the sense of both male and female, and whatever else man thinks they can make in between. Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the animals in all the earth and all the creeping things that creep on the earth. And God created man, or humanity, in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And he blessed them. God blessed them, and he said to them, God said to them, be fruitful and increase and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over all the creatures that creep on the ground. What I'm going to argue is very simple, that when it says that humans were made in the image of God and according to his likeness, it's talking about a covenant relationship. This is difficult because in the last 2,000 years, there have been many different ideas about the image of God. Here are the basic views. The early church fathers thought that image and likeness were distinct aspects of man's nature. The image denotes the natural qualities in humans that make him like God, while the likeness refers to the supernatural graces which make the redeemed godlike. Unfortunately, when you study the word image and likeness in Hebrew, it does not support this interpretation. I don't want to be arrogant. Why should I, after 2,000 years, think that I might have a better interpretation than the people in the 2,000 years before me? Let me just give you a quick explanation. It's not because I'm a great scholar. For the first 1,500 years, the church was only reading the Bible in Greek and Latin. There was nobody reading the Bible in Hebrew until Martin Luther. Okay? Secondly, the church has only been reading the Bible in Hebrew for 500 years. The last 250, most of the Old Testament scholars don't believe anything that they're reading. And they don't believe that this book comes from God, and they don't take it as a unity. So if you don't think that there's a plot structure, you're not going to understand the parts. How do you think you're going to understand individual episodes if you don't have the big picture of the plot structure? What happened in the Enlightenment period is there was an emphasis on reason. We could solve everything by making reason the highest criterion in life. And what that does is you end up with the little itty bits, but you have no big picture. Another reason is that we have made big discoveries in art through archaeology that show us the culture in the ancient Near East and give us a better understanding of the language that was used in the 15th century BC. And I'm simply a follower of Jesus Christ who is using these tools to understand the Bible. Just as one example, 40 years ago, we did not know what an Israelite house looked like and how to tell the difference between an Israelite house and a Canaanite house. We know that now. So there are many incredible discoveries, and we can use these. We can use these to have a better understanding of the Bible. My basic assumption is that Jesus Christ is the Lord of all truth, and only those who know him will have the larger story that helps everything fit together.
Amen.
Secondly, there are people who think that the divine image refers to the mental and spiritual qualities that humans share with the Creator. The fact that commentators can't agree on identifying these qualities makes this approach a problem. Three, some have argued that the image consists of a physical resemblance. Before we dismiss this out of hand, let us note that the Hebrew word tselem, meaning image, does refer to a physical image in most of the places in the Bible. Moreover, in Genesis 5, Adam is described as being the father of Seth after his image, which most likely refers to physical appearance. The Old Testament emphasizes, however, that God has no bodily form. He is a spirit being. Also, if the language is related to Egyptian and Mesopotamian thinking, The image of God there refers to the function of the king and not to his appearance. Finally, the image of God is what separates man from the animals. We could actually take a whole hour to talk about this. Let me just say this in 2 minutes. A lot of people think that the soul is what distinguishes man from the animals. But animals have souls just like humans. Genesis 2 verse 7 says, there are three sentences in Genesis 2 verse 7. The first sentence is, Yahweh God formed the man out of dust from the ground. That's the material part. That's the part you can touch and feel. Okay? And I'll tell you another thing. Do you know why there are so many different skin colors in this room? They're all colors of the soil. They are not a mark or badge of honor. They're a reminder of our lowly origin. All skin colors are soil colors. God made man out of the dust of the ground. Second, God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. You have the breath of God in you. So there's a part of you that you can't touch. We call it the spirit. Thirdly, notice the last sentence. And the man became a living soul. This is what happened when the material and the immaterial came together. Do you see that? The third sentence is a result clause. It's the result of bringing the Spirit of God being joined to the material. So it's better to say, you can say, I have a soul, because you are a soul. And scientists today have never been able to separate the spirit from the body. Let me give you an example. Where does the brain end and the mind begin? There is no scientist today who can tell me that. It's a mystery how the material and the immaterial come together. When I was at the University of Toronto, I took a course in psychology. I read Behaviorism by John Watson. He told me, your thoughts are just chemical reactions. I don't believe it. John Watson was wrong. There's a lot more going on there than just chemical reactions. Do you think you're just a bunch of chemical reactions? So the soul is the unique bringing together of the body and the spirit, and we don't know where the body ends and the spirit begins. The author of Genesis, Moses, did not take time to talk about the creation of the animals, but in verse 19, he says that they are living souls. The problem with most English translations is they do not make this clear. So just as humans are living souls in verse 7, animals are living souls in verse 19. And there are verses I won't bring them up now, there are verses in the Psalms and the book of Job that show that the animals have the breath of God in them, just like humans. And Ecclesiastes says there's no difference between man and the animals when we die. The body goes into the ground and the spirit, who knows where the spirit goes? There's an answer to that question in the Christian faith, but I'm just leaving it open right now. So animals are souls. And the only difference between animals and humans is that we are made as the image of God. And so we're going to find out what that means. The problem with I don't know about your upbringing. I was raised in Canada when there was a very strong Greco-Roman heritage. And so we were influenced by Plato into thinking that the soul is the immortal part inside of you that escapes upon death. This is just what people think. That's only what the Greek people thought. They were smart, but they were wrong. divine image makes man God's representative on earth. Well, I'm going to show that the ruling function is a result of being made as God's image. It's not the image itself. Fifthly, the image is a capacity to relate to God. Klaus Westermann argued that the image of God is not part of the human constitution, as it is a description of the process of creation which made man different. There's a lot to commend this view, but when we look at the Bible, it suggests that the image describes the product of creation rather than the process. Let's critique the traditional view. Most people... when did we start? 10:20. So we're going to 11:10 then. 11:10. Okay. Most people think this way. They look at Genesis 1 and they say, they see the statement, man is made in the divine image. And they say, well, God is invisible, so this has nothing to do with the physical part. It must have something to do with the part we can't see. And then they try to identify something in the part that we can't see. This is good reasoning, but it's not an explanation of the text. It's not asking the question, what did this text mean in the 15th century BC according to the language of that time, according to the cultural setting of that time? According to the literary structure, which is part of how things communicate. When you listen to music, there's the music and the lyrics, and those are supposed to work together to communicate the message. The lyrics is not the whole thing. The music is half of the message, isn't it? The literary structure is like the music that carries the words. And the larger plot structure, all of those are important for interpreting the text. When we look at this text, then we start with a literary structure. You'll get to know me and you'll see that's always where we start. The structure of Genesis 1, 24 to 31 has a different structure from all of the other paragraphs. First, there's a part dealing with the creation of animals, and then there's a part dealing with the creation of man, or humans. And instead of God saying, let something happen, we have a very unusual statement. There's a divine decision. Let us make man, to give him a certain role, to make him and to give him a certain role. Then we see the execution of that decision. God makes him and God proclaims his role. Then we have the food rules and the evaluation and day notation. We can see here that there is a correspondence between the divine decision and the divine execution. God wants to make man and to give him a certain role, and then he makes him and gives him that role. 2 points of grammar. So this may be the heaviest part of today because nobody likes grammar. Although this is not brought out in our modern translations, the second sentence in verse 26 is a purpose clause. God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, so that they may rule. I don't know why our translations do not express it this way, because this is not the statement of a great Hebrew scholar. This is something that is in every beginning grammar of Hebrew. So I don't know what happened in the translations. Don't ask me, because I only read the Greek, the Hebrew Bible and the Greek Bible, and that's all I've read for the last 35 years. So don't ask me about English translations. Secondly, I want us to look at verse 27. And we see 3 sentences there. God created the man in his image. That's the end of the first sentence. The second sentence says, in the image of God, he created him. And the third sentence says, male and female, he created them. Now, this is a part of Hebrew grammar that isn't always well understood today. It's a new area called discourse grammar or text linguistics. The first sentence, the author is telling us what happened. And then the story stops to give you two footnotes. So the last two sentences are footnotes. It's not this happened and this happened and this happened. It's this happened, now two footnotes before I can go on. Do you see that? The two footnotes tell us that God made humans like him in some way, and that he made them male and female. This prepares us for the next verse. In the next verse, there are five command forms, but really there are only two commands. Look at verse 28. God blessed them, and he said to them, God said to them, now look at these five commands. Be fruitful and increase and fill the earth. That's three commands. And subdue it and rule over it. So in reality, even though there are five verbs, there are only two commands. One command has to do with being fruitful, and the other command has to do with ruling. Can you see that? Well, the two footnotes prepare us for this. The footnote that we're male and female prepare us for the command to be fruitful, because it does take a male and a female to be fruitful. Even today. In our very sophisticated world. And the command and the statement that we're made as God's image prepares us for the command to rule. One of the most annoying things to Westerners is that Hebrews always repeat themselves endlessly. So if you have a Hebrew writer, and he's going to talk about two things, and he's going to repeat both of them, A and B, he could order them, he could have A, B, and then A repeat and B repeat. But he could do it a different way. He could have A, B, B repeat, A repeat. This is what's called a chiastic structure, don't worry about that. But that's what we have here. We have a chiastic structure so that we have image, male, female, fruitfulness, image, ruling. So the image and the ruling go together, and the male and female goes with the being fruitful. Do you all see that? This means that gender roles have nothing to do with the divine image. In fact, the Hebrew word Adam means all humans, whether male or female, are made as God's image. And the fact that we're made as male and female doesn't reflect anything in God. God is neither male nor female, although he does most often use the male gender. There are images with the female gender too. There's a great confusion. What a lot of people today believe comes from Karl Barth. He was a great scholar, but he wasn't a good Hebrew scholar, and he didn't understand this text. We're now ready to study this text. I'm going to give you a little example first. We're going to study the ancient Near Eastern background. We're going to study the meaning of the nouns, likeness and image, and we're going to study the prepositions in and according to. And before we do this, I want to talk about how God communicates. God communicates in the only way that persons can communicate. You have to start with what the other person knows before you can tell them something they don't know. And so when God communicates in the Bible, he starts with the culture and language of the people that he's talking to in order to instruct them and tell them what he wants to tell them. Let me illustrate this. I want you to think about the tabernacle. The tabernacle is a tent that they built for worship. Exodus 25 to 40, God instructed Moses and the Israelites to build a movable tent, which was a kind of a movable temple, a movable place of worship. Might not be a bad idea for what's happening in the world today. And when I was a boy, I thought that this tent, that Moses was told to follow the instructions very carefully, and I thought that's because this temple was unlike any other temple in the ancient Near East. But then my faith was shaken when I read a book and I saw the plans, the floor plans of over 100 temples from the ancient Near East. They're all the same. They all have an outer courtyard. You come in through the altar of sacrifice, and there's a building with two rooms, an outer room and an inner room, a holy place and a holy of holies. So you see, the first time that the Israelites saw this, it was exactly like every other temple that existed in the ancient Near East. God is starting with what they understand. There's one tiny difference between this temple and all other temples. In the other temples, in the Canaanite temples, you go through the altar of sacrifice, you go into the holy place, and you go into the inner room. What do you find in the inner room? You find a statue, and this statue represents one of the forces of nature, because they were worshiping all of the forces of nature, just like we do today, our technology, our medicine, whatever we can hold in our hands. Their worship services were sex orgies because they believed in sympathetic magic, which means if we get things going downstairs, the gods will get things going upstairs, and the rain will fall. They worshiped the rain god. His name was Baal. They actually thought that the rain was Baal's semen making the land fertile. This is what's called sympathetic magic, which means manipulating the powers that be to guarantee the good life for yourself. This is what we do when we go to the economic bargaining table, to the G7 meetings, this is what our politicians are doing, this is what our medical people are doing, this is what our scientists are doing, this is what we're doing with our technology. We're manipulating the powers that be to guarantee the good life for ourselves. So what happens when the Israelite comes into this temple, goes past the altar of sacrifice, goes from the outer room into the inner room? There's a shock, because there's no statue there. God has already made his statue. We'll get there. There's nothing in there but a little box. And what's in the box? The Ten Commandments. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against the reputation of your neighbor. See, what God is saying is you have to get rid of your magic. The only way to guarantee the good life is ethics. Ethics determines the future, not magic. If you want the good life, you have to come my way. It's my way or the highway, a long time before Sinatra. All right? So what I'm trying to show you is that when God communicates, he starts with what they know, but there's a difference. And so the proper way to interpret the Bible is to compare it with the surrounding culture and to contrast it with the surrounding culture. A lot of liberal theologians see the similarities. Many conservative Christians are afraid to see the similarities, but the similarities are there. A lot of the liberals say, well, Israel just copied everything from the surrounding nations, but there's no temple like Israel anywhere in the ancient Near East with nothing in the inner room. So God must have spoken to Moses, because that idea doesn't come from any of their surrounding nations. That's why I believe God actually spoke to Moses, because these ideas aren't found in Egypt and Mesopotamia. All right, we're going to talk quickly here. You remember that the people of Israel spent 400 years in Egypt before they came to Canaan. So we're going to start with Egypt. In Egypt, from 1630 BC onward, the king, the Pharaoh, was called the living statue of the god. And he was considered the living statue of the god because he was considered to be the son of God. So when Pharaoh walked down the street, you were looking at the son of God. Now, the emphasis is not on physical behavior, on physical appearance, because a male king could be the image of a female goddess. So it's the behavior of the king that reflects the behavior of the god. Commonly associated with the image is the notion of conquest and power. A clear example is an inscription from the Karnak Temple marking the triumph of Thutmose III at Karnak around 460 BC. So I'm quoting here a text from Egypt that comes from the time of the Exodus. And the god says to the king, "I came to let you tread on the Jahish chiefs. I spread them under your feet throughout their lands. I let them see your majesty as Lord of Light, so that you shone before them in my likeness." And in the prologue, the god calls the king his son. So the king is the son of God, and when he conquers other nations, he's reflecting the likeness of his god. Do you see that? In the 13th century BC, Pharaoh Ramses II had his image hewn out of the rock at the mouth of the Kelb River on the Mediterranean just north of Beirut. His image, like the presidents on Mount Rushmore, meant that he was the ruler of that area. So in the ancient Near East, since the king is the living statue of the god, he represents the god on earth, and he makes the power of the god a present reality. To sum up, in the word image of God and likeness convey two ideas, rulership and sonship. The king is the image of God because he has a relationship to his God as the son of God, and he has a relationship to the world as a ruler for that God. In the ancient Near East, these would have been understood as covenant relationships. Because when you say son, you're talking family, and family relationships are always covenantal. We ought to assume that the meaning in the Bible is identical unless the Bible tells us differently. Particularly important for Genesis 1 is the usage of the words likeness and image in the Tel Fekaria inscription. I have this on my computer, but we can't show it to you without the screen here, and that's not a problem. It's a big statue of a king. This king, his name was Hadouyithi of Gozan, a city in what is now eastern Syria. And it has a bilingual inscription on it in Akkadian and Aramaic. This inscription is from the 10th or 9th century BC. It's one of the first things I read when I went to do my PhD. The text is divided into two paragraphs. The first paragraph focuses on the king in terms of his relationship to his God. The first paragraph focuses on the king as a worshiper of his God, and the main word in that paragraph is demutha, which is exactly the same word in Hebrew for likeness. The second paragraph focuses on the power of the king in relation to his subjects. He's majestic. He's powerful. And the key word in that paragraph is tsalma, which is the same word as the Hebrew word for image. So we can see that when the Bible says that God made the man in his image and according to his likeness, it means that we were created to have a covenant relationship with God as a son or daughter of God. And we're created to have a relationship with the rest of the world that could be described as servant kingship. I have to summarize some things. This information does not simply come from the ancient Near East. This interpretation is backed up by the Bible, because in Genesis 5, the fact that likeness shows that humanity has a special relationship to God, like that of father and son, is proven in Genesis 5, verses 1 to 3, where Adam has a son called Seth in his likeness and after his image. So you can see that that's a father-son relationship, exactly like the relationship between God and man. Now, Adam is not a literal son of God. It's a figure of speech. It's a metaphor, but it's talking about a covenant relationship between God and humans. This interpretation is supported by the rest of the Bible. In Luke 3, when Luke gives the genealogy of Jesus and traces him right back to Adam, he says that Adam was the son of God. Where did Luke get that idea? It must have come from the Bible somewhere. Why not from the creation story? So if you don't think my interpretation is correct, Luke does. We see later on that Israel inherits the role of Adam and Eve, and Moses is told to go to Pharaoh and say, "Israel is my son, my firstborn son. Let my son go that he may serve me." So then Israel, in its Adamic role, inherits the title Son of God. The term image indicates that man has a special position and status as king under God. Humans rule as a result of this royal status. And the words that are used in Genesis 1:27 to rule and subdue are words that are used for kings elsewhere in the Old Testament. Psalm 8 is also a commentary on this text. Listen to this. The oldest commentary on Genesis 1 is inspired, because in Psalm 8, verses 5 through 8, David is commenting on Genesis 1, 26 and 27, word by word. So that when he says that God created humans to be a little lower than the gods or next to the gods, it's his way of saying that we're made as the divine image. And then he says that we're made to rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air. So David's understanding is the same one that I have. And when we look at Ephesians 4 and Colossians 1, where this image is renewed in Jesus Christ, Paul talks about righteousness and holiness, which derive from the truth, and he talks about knowledge. He's not talking about the image of God as qualities in man. Those are words that describe a covenant relationship. So we've seen the similarities. Let's look at the differences. One of the biggest differences is that in the ancient Near East, only the king is the image of God. In the Bible, all humans are the image of God. Do you see that? That's a powerful difference. That idea didn't come from anywhere in the ancient Near East. that came because God actually spoke to Moses. We're going to talk quickly about the meaning of the word in and the meaning of the word as. In one way, there's two different interpretations. Being made in the image could be saying that I'm made like a representation or a copy of God. I don't think that's the right interpretation. I think it's saying being made in the image is actually being made as God's image. I am a copy of God himself. Well, surely Moses could have said that man is the image of God. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 that man is the image of God. So if you can't see it in Genesis, you can see it in the New Testament. But I think Moses wanted to nuance his statement so that people would not worship humans as idols. And so he put it, he is communicating very clearly in Hebrew, but he's communicating a little more subtly than Paul. Sometimes we don't get it subtly, and so we have to get beat over the head with somebody who's politically incorrect, like Paul. These two prepositions have different meanings. The word in means to be very close to something, very much like something. The word as or according to means to be similar but yet different. And what this shows, when we're made in the image of God, that means we're very close to God in terms of ruling. We're just like God in extending his rule in the earth. The word likeness is related with generation, with creation. You can actually see that in Genesis 5 when Adam generates a son in his likeness. And so what this means is when we rule, we're supposed to rule just like God. But when we create humans, we don't create like God creates. Do you see the difference? It's very subtle. So we're similar, but there's a difference there. So what we see happening is this interpretation honors the fact that the word image usually refers to physical statues. God has put his statue in the world. Just like Pharaoh carved his image on the rock to show that he was the Lord of this area, God has put his statue in the world to show that he is Lord over this world. This is not simply a functional role. This is, if I could use a terminology of today, this is computer hardware as opposed to software. This is not simply a program that can operate in this machinery. This is the machinery itself. You are hardwired to have a relationship with God, of love, of loyalty, of faithfulness, of trust, of obedience, of total commitment. And when you begin to see how great God is, you will be totally devoted to him. And you are made to treat other people in genuinely human ways with social justice and to be good stewards of the earth's resources. Not like the kings of the ancient Near East who use the country's resources for themselves. The kings of the ancient Near East are like the kings of the East today, and of course like Western governments too. Who's the richest man in the world? Maybe King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, amassing the country's resources for his own benefit. That's what Saddam Hussein was doing with Iraq, wasn't it? Remember President Marcos and his wife? Does anyone remember them? When they got kicked out of the Philippines, Mrs. Marcos had 3,000 pairs of shoes, amassing the country's resources for themselves. This is not the kind of kingship that God wants. His kingship is a kingship that serves the creation. I have about 3 minutes, and I want to put it this way. I want to tell you how to understand Hebrew literature. The first thing is that Hebrews are always going to repeat themselves. This may be very annoying for you. But the way it works is this. What they do is they start up a conversation on a topic, and they go around that topic, and then they shut that conversation down. Then they start up another conversation over here, and they go around that topic. And when after you're finished, you realize that these two conversations are actually about the same topic, but they're from a different angle or from a different perspective. And so it's like the left and right speakers of a stereo system. When you have the left and right speakers, is the music coming out of those speakers the same or is it different? Well, it's both the same and different. Of course it has to be the same music, but the fact that one is slightly different from the other allows you that stereo effect. And that's why Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, Genesis 1 is the left speaker, Genesis 2 is the right speaker. And when you listen to both of those speakers, you're going to have a three-dimensional idea, or just like Dolby surround sound, or like 3D movies, or holographic images, you're going to have a three-dimensional idea. Our culture is based on the Greece and Rome, and we are influenced by Aristotle, Aristotelian rectilinear logic, which means all scientific treatises start at A, and they go in a straight line to B by means of logical syllogisms. That's how our literature works. But this is better literature because it's Dolby surround all long time before that was invented. DTS 7.1 even. I don't have time to go into Genesis 2, but I'm going to summarize what's in my book in a couple of sentences. Genesis 2 pictures Adam as a priest in a garden temple. So the garden is actually described as a sanctuary, as a temple, as a place of worship. Read the book and you'll see that. And Adam is described as a king and as a priest. We think of gardeners as a lowly job, but who built the hanging gardens of Babylon? Nebuchadnezzar. You see, in the ancient Near East, kings are gardeners, not just lowly people. It's not just a lowly job. It's the job of a king. And what the Bible is saying is, how is Adam supposed to rule the world? Well, he has all these jobs to do, right? My goodness, how is he going to subdue all of the animals and subdue all of the plants? Man, he's alone in the huge world. How is he going to do this? He's going to get out his iPhone and start making a list of all the things that he has to do, right? Wrong. The first priority for Adam is to get into the temple and meet God. His first priority is worship. His first priority is to know God. When he spends time with God, you know what's going to happen? He's going to talk like God. He's going to think like God. He's going to act like God. So when he walks out into the world, he will rule like God. He will do those jobs the way God would, because he will be a real copy of God. So that's what happens when you put the right speaker with the left speaker in Genesis 1 and 2. The liberals were totally wrong. They thought that these were two different sources patched together, but they never asked themselves the question, how do Hebrews tell stories? The problem with the last 250 years of scholarship, especially in Germany, is they're using modern and Western methods to analyze ancient and Eastern texts. Amen.